Hi, and welcome back to another episode of the Biographics Podcast. My name is Simon Whistler. This is a podcast version of a video that originally aired on our YouTube channel. You can find that by searching YouTube for Biographics. If you like this audio version of that video, please do consider leaving us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. And let's get into today's podcast.
In the summer of 1976, the city of New York was thrown into a state of terror. A madman was on the loose, wandering the streets and killing people at random. This was a killer who loved publicity, sending vicious, taunting letters to the police and the media. Each one was signed with the moniker Son of Sam. When fate finally caught up with the monster, he was revealed to be a chubby introvert by the name of David Berkowitz. In the Biographics video today, we discover his story. The child who would become the Son of Sam was born Richard David Falco on June 1, 1953. His mother, Betty Broder, had been previously married to a man named Tony Falco, but when he left her for another woman, she began a relationship with a married man named Joseph Kleinman. Betty and Tony already had a child, Roslyn, and when Kleinman found out that she was pregnant again, he pressured her to give the baby up for adoption. It appears that he also forbade Betty from giving the child his name, which is why she gave the child her former husband's last name. A few days after birth, Richard was adopted by a middle-aged couple named Nathan and Pearl Berkowitz, who lived in New York's Bronx neighborhood. The Berkowitzes owned a hardware store, which occupied a large portion of Nathan's time. He was never close with his adopted son, who he called David, considering the adoption to be a mistake. As David was her only child, Pearl was extremely close to the boy, though. She indulged David and let him get away with things that he shouldn't have. David developed into a difficult child. He was hyperactive, mischievous, and ornery. He was a bulky child and quickly learned that he could use his size to his advantage and lord it over other children. He showed little interest in schooling, and through a combination of truancy and feigned illnesses, he missed class a lot of the time. When he was 7 years old, David was hit by a car and he suffered head injuries. It's unclear whether this resulted in any long-term effects. Soon after, though, he started to show signs of a fascination with fire. He began burning bugs and advanced to starting fires around his neighborhood. This didn't bring him to the attention of the authorities, though his adoptive parents did take him to see a psychotherapist. When he was 14, David's life was turned upside down with the death of his adoptive mother. Pearl had been fighting breast cancer for 2 years. Pearl was the only person with whom David had a close relationship, and he was shocked to watch her decline as she went through chemotherapy treatment. Her death, it was a crushing blow. In the year after his mother's death, David became increasingly introverted. His schoolwork suffered drastically as he fell into a dark depression. He had no relationship with his father, and things worsened when Joseph remarried. His new stepmother was even more distant than his father. When the family relocated to Boynton Beach near Miami, Florida, David's isolation, it became complete. With no friends and no family connection, he created a fantasy world in order to cope with his loneliness. In 1971, at the age of 18, David found a means to escape his dismal life with his father and stepmother. He joined the army, and after basic training, he was sent to Korea. Army life, it was transformative for the troubled young man. He seemed to respond well to the discipline that it provided and generally equipped him well. He trained as a marksman and became a good shot. In 1974, he was honorably discharged. After leaving the army, David returned to New York. Here, he was completely on his own. He used money he had saved during his army years to rent an apartment in the Bronx and took classes at Bronx Community College. People remember him at this time as an angry and argumentative young man who shunned association with others. To support himself, he worked a number of odd jobs, including mail sorter, security guard, and cab driver. Though very quiet, Berkowitz quickly came to the attention of his neighbors and the local police department. He would instigate petty disputes and escalate them with personal threats. A man who lived on the floor below, Deputy Police Sheriff Charles Glassman, received 4 handwritten threats from Berkowitz. In his early 20s, Berkowitz connected with his birth mother. He began regular visits with Betty and his half-sister Rosalyn. However, when he found out that Betty had given him up for adoption after succumbing to pressure from his birth father, he did not react very well. In fact, he cut the two women out of his life completely and never visited again. Then, in 1974, Berkowitz's fascination with fire resurfaced. Over the next 3 years, he set more than 1,500 fires around New York City. David diligently recorded the details of each arson in his journal, referring to himself as the Phantom of the Bronx. Firelighting gave him some control over his situation that he couldn't find anywhere else in his life. In 1975, Berkowitz developed another fascination, and this time it was with the occult. After reading the Satanic Bible by Anton LaVey, the founder of the Church of Satan, he became convinced that he was being controlled by evil spirits. In late November 1975, Berkowitz wrote a letter to his father. In it, he said, "It's cold and gloomy here in New York, but that's okay because the weather fits my mood. Gloomy. Dad, the world is getting dark now." A month later, on Christmas Eve, he took hold of a hunting knife and headed out to satisfy his bloodlust. His first victim was a woman coming out of a grocery store. Berkowitz stabbed her several times before she managed to run away. He then came across a 15-year-old by the name of Michelle Foreman. She was stabbed 6 times, but fought off her attacker and made it to the safety of a nearby apartment. At the end of January 1976, Berkowitz had relocated from the Bronx to a rental house in Yonkers. His landlords owned a German Shepherd dog, which barked incessantly. Berkowitz would later claim that this dog was possessed by Satan and its barking was commands for him to kill women. At the time, he was working a night shift job as a security guard. He recalled that the constant barking almost caused him to take his own life. After 3 months, the noise was too much for Berkowitz, and he moved to an apartment at 35 Pine Street at Yonkers. As it turns out, he was unable to avoid the barking of dogs, and he took this as a sign that Satan was driving him to murder. He used a Molotov cocktail to kill the dog belonging to his neighbor, a man named Sam Carr. When this didn't work, he shot the dog. Berkowitz was convinced that Sam Carr was possessed by the devil, and it was from him that he came up with the name Son of Sam. His 2 botched knife attacks convinced Berkowitz that he needed a more effective means of killing. By June of 1976, he had built up a formidable arsenal of firearms that included a .44 caliber revolver, a Commando Mark III rifle, a Glenfield rifle with a telescopic sight, Charter Arms AR-7 Explorer shotgun, and a 12-gauge Ithaca Deerslayer shotgun. Towards the end of June 1976, Berkowitz quit his job as a security guard and began driving for the Co-op City Taxi Company. But that job, it didn't last long. By the end of July, he was working a day job as an installer of air conditioning ducts. Berkowitz's first kill, it came on July the 29th, 1976. He left his apartment via the fire escape shortly before 1 a.m. with his .44 caliber handgun in a paper bag. He hopped into his car and began cruising for a victim. He came across 18-year-old Donna Loria and her 19-year-old friend Jody Valenti talking in a car outside Donna's apartment. Berkowitz approached Donna's side window, squatted down into a firing position, and holding the gun with both hands, emptied the chamber. Donna was shot and killed. Jody was wounded, and she reacted by screaming and desperately honking the car horn. Jody survived. With his gun empty, Berkowitz melted into the night. He was filled with a euphoria that he had never known before, and his addiction to murder was well underway. The next attack, it came 3 months later, on October the 23rd. Berkowitz was again cruising for a victim in the dead of the night. He was driving down a street in Flushing, Queens, when he spotted 2 people in a red Ford Galaxy. One of them had long black hair, which he found attractive. He began following them, and when they came to a stop, he parked behind them. Berkowitz had set his sights on 20-year-old Carl DeNaro and his 18-year-old date, Rosemary Keenan, who happened to be the daughter of a New York City police officer. Following the same pattern of his first murder, Berkowitz approached the passenger window, pulled out his handgun, and fired 5 times. One of the bullets smashed into Carl's head, but an uninjured Rosemary managed to escape the car and flee. When Berkowitz left, she returned and drove Carl to the hospital. Amazingly, he survived, with doctors having to insert a metal plate into his skull. A month later, Berkowitz struck again. This time, his victims were a couple of teenage girls, Joanne Lamino and Donna DeMasi. They were on their way home from the movies. Berkowitz walked behind them, and as they stood on the stoop of Joanne's house talking, he opened up with his handgun. Then he disappeared. Bullets tore through the bodies of both girls, but neither was killed, although Joanne was paralyzed from the waist down. The attacks, they continued. On January the 30th, 1977, Berkowitz shot and killed Christine Frond, who had just seen the movie Rocky with her boyfriend. As with most of the previous attacks, the couple were sitting in their car when Berkowitz opened fire. Then, on March the 8th, he killed a 20-year-old Bulgarian immigrant by the name of Virginia Voxkharikian. Virginia was walking home from Columbia University when she came face to face with Berkowitz. He shot her in the face at point-blank range and then left her to die on the sidewalk. Then, on April the 17th, he attacked Valentina Siriani and Alexander Asso as they sat in their car at 3 a.m. Siriani died at the scene, while Asso died hours later. Police came to the scene, and they found a letter that had been left by the killer. It read in part, "I'm a monster. I am the son of Sam. I feel like an outsider. I am on a different wavelength than everybody else. Programmed to kill. However, to stop me, you must kill me. I am the monster, Beelzebub, the chubby beer-mouth I love to hunt. Prowling the streets, looking for fair game, tasty meat. The women of Queens are prettiest of all." By now, the entire city of New York was in an uproar. Fear over the next attack by the Son of Sam led to a rush on handgun sales and a dramatic emptying of nighttime entertainment venues. The information that the majority of victims had long dark hair led to an overnight hairstyle change as women rushed to get their hair cut and then dyed. The media was all over the story, with coverage going global, but still, the attacks continued with chilling regularity. Berkowitz, he next struck on June the 26th, 1977. Judy Placido, age 17, and Sal Lupo, age 20, were sitting in Lupo's car around 3 a.m. when Berkowitz attacked in his usual way. Placido was shot three times, while Lupo was shot once. Both survived. A month later, he attacked Bobby Violante and Stacy Moskowitz, both age 20. Again, Berkowitz fired through the passenger car window, striking both of his victims in the head. Violante survived, though he lost 90% of his vision, but Stacy Moskowitz died 2 days later. She marked the last victim of the Son of Sam. On March 30, 1977, media hysteria was ratcheted up even further when New York's most prominent crime writer, New York Times columnist Jimmy Breslin, received a handwritten letter from a person claiming to be the Son of Sam. It included the following: "Mr. Breslin, sir, don't think that because you haven't heard from me for a while that I went to sleep. No, rather, I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam. I love my work. Now the void has been filled. Perhaps we shall meet face to face someday, or perhaps I will be blown away by cops with smoking 38s. Breslin contacted the police, who noted that the letter contained details of some of the crimes that had not yet been released to the public. They allowed the Times to publish part of the letter as a companion to Breslin's printed response, which urged the killer to turn himself in. That edition of the Times sold more than a million copies. The NYPD formed Operation Omega, the most comprehensive investigation in its history, in order to bring the Son of Sam to justice. Over 300 detectives worked around the clock at a daily cost of $90,000. 45 psychiatrists pored over the taunting letters that Berkowitz was writing, with the general consensus being that he was a paranoid loner who was unable to form relationships and with possible connections to devil worship. On the night of the Moskowitz-Violante shooting, a woman named Cecilia Davis was walking her dog when she saw a police officer ticketing a young man in a car that was parked alongside a fire hydrant. Soon thereafter, she saw what appeared to be the same young man walk past her, staring at her menacingly. It was enough to scare her into a speedy dash home. After the murders, Miss Davis gave the information to the police. As a result of this, every driver who had been ticketed that night was brought in for questioning. And one of the people on that list was David Berkowitz. A detective tried to get hold of Berkowitz over the phone, but there was no answer. The detective then contacted the Yonkers police station to see if they could help get him in touch with Berkowitz. The dispatcher he spoke to just happened to be the daughter of Sam Carr, David's former landlord and the inspiration for the Son of Sam label that Berkowitz had anointed himself with. The detective interviewed Sam Carr, who informed him that Berkowitz had shot his dog and was a pretty troubled individual. The physical and psychological description that was given seemed to gel rather well with the profile of the Son of Sam. From this point on, evidence against Berkowitz quickly mounted. A suspected arson was reported close to his apartment. Police interviewed David's former neighbor, Charles Glassman, who showed them the nasty letters that Berkowitz had written to him. On August the 10th, 1977, detectives found his Ford Galaxy parked outside his apartment. Although they didn't have a search warrant, they began searching the car. On the back seat was a duffel bag containing a rifle. Inside the glove compartment was a handwritten letter addressed to the Suffolk County Police Department that warned of a coming attack on a disco. One of the officers was sent to get a search warrant while the officers stayed by the car. A member of the public was told to park his car so as to box in the Ford, making it hard for Berkowitz to get away if he came out of his apartment. A SWAT team was deployed around the area. Finally, at around 10:30 p.m., Berkowitz came out of his apartment and got into his car. A detective approached and tapped on his window. The Son of Sam then rolled down the window and said, "Well, you got me. How come it took you such a long time?" The arrest of the Son of Sam caused a worldwide sensation. It turned out that the monster who had terrorized the world's most famous city was a rather pathetic-looking loser. Berkowitz admitted to all of the attacks, providing details that only the perpetrator would know. On August the 11th, he was charged with second-degree murder for the killing of Stacy Moskowitz. The judge ordered a psychological evaluation to determine if he was fit to stand trial. Meanwhile, the media was in a frenzy to cover every angle of the Son of Sam story. This resulted in the state of New York enacting what became known as the Son of Sam laws, permitting the state to confiscate the proceeds from any earnings made as proceeds of a crime for a period of 5 years after the act was committed. This money would then go to the victims of the crime. As it turned out, though, there was to be no trial. Berkowitz pled guilty to 6 counts of murder and refused the urging of his attorney to claim a defense of insanity. He later stated, "I just wanted to end it, and I was so distraught. I just confessed and pled guilty and got it over with, and just wanted to get out of that environment." During his sentencing, the mother of Stacy Moskowitz stood up and said, "I could kill him with my bare hands, and I am not a violent person. I could probably kill him and go for dinner and go to sleep that night truly peacefully." During Mrs. Moskowitz's statement, Berkowitz repeated over and over that Stacy is a whore. Then he burst from his seat and made for the courtroom window. He was eventually restrained, but not before knocking down several officers. Sentencing was delayed until June 12, 1978, on which date he was sentenced to 6 consecutive life sentences. Berkowitz proved to be a problem prisoner. He reveled in tormenting other inmates. Because of his rage, other inmates referred to him as Berserkowitz. On July 10, 1979, he was attacked by another inmate with a razor. The resulting neck injuries, they required 57 stitches. After 10 years of confinement, Berkowitz became a born-again Christian. This angry mass killer was converted into an evangelical pacifist. He absorbed himself in a letter-writing campaign to spread the message of the Bible. Over the years, a following developed around Berkowitz as the ultimate example of the changed man, the modern-day equivalent of the Apostle Paul. Berkowitz first became eligible for parole in 2002. However, he sent a letter to the parole board requesting that the hearing be cancelled. In it, he stated, "In all honesty, I believe that I deserve to be in prison for the rest of my life. I have, with God's help, long ago come to terms with my situation, and I have accepted my punishment." He has been up for parole every 2 years since 2002, but he has consistently refused the opportunity to seek his freedom. As a result, he remains in prison to this very day, where he is considered to be a model prisoner.
Really hope you enjoyed that one. If you did, you know what to do. Go over to iTunes, leave us a review, or wherever you get your podcasts. That might not be iTunes, that can be Stitcher or, oh, there's so many. It really helps out. It gets this in front of more people. I'd appreciate it. And as always, thanks for listening.